Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, January 12, 2025, is by the Reverend Barbara Threat on the topic of MLK, Dream to Nightmare.
A week from tomorrow, among other events, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King will be remembered in ceremony and services and potlucks all across America. January 20th. His brilliant I Have a Dream speech will be recited countless times, and many of his accomplishments will be recalled. King's involvement in the 13-month-long bus boycott in Montgomery that followed Rosa Parks' refusal to move in 1955. The March on Washington in August of 63, where he gave that famous I Have a Dream speech. The confrontation at Pettus Bridge in Selma in 1965, King's books and sermons will be quoted as we hear about a man who struggled for equal rights for all Americans, regardless of color, the right to vote, to ride the same buses, to eat at the same restaurants, use the same restrooms, and attend the same schools. For this work and more, Reverend Dr. King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964. All of this work was and still is tremendously important to everyone in our country, and it is certainly worthy of our nation's attention and honor. King didn't die, though, until April 4, 1968. He continued his work from that first rise to prominence in 1955 through the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 64 and the Voting Rights Bill in 65, and on until his murder. I want to speak today about those last few years of his life, years when King's own perception of many situations in this country changed and things looked a little less hopeful, years when the perception of King himself changed, too, in many quarters. In his book, Martin Luther King, The Inconvenient Hero, Vincent Harding writes, "It appears as if we are determined to hold this hero captive to the powerful period that culminated in the magnificent March on Washington in 1963, refusing to let him branch out beyond the eloquence of I Have a Dream." Somehow King seems easier to manage as a hero if we forget his later search for economic justice, his determination to identify with poor people of all colors, his move into the exploding cauldron of the North, his strident denunciation of American and not just Southern white racism, and his courageous stance against the violence of the escalating war in Vietnam. He called for a revolutionary transformation of the nation's institutions across the board, and he became more than a hero. He became a challenge, even a nightmare in some people's perceptions. I would suggest there is serious danger in holding too tightly to the King of I Have a Dream, and of holding onto the location of most of his work as being in the Deep South. Celebrating the Voting Rights Act or the desegregation of lunch counters as if they're done deals, etched into stone with the certainty that they'll be that way for all time, allows us to relax into gratitude for a completed work. And as we've learned in the past few years, the work of creating justice is never fully completed. And what has been achieved won't inevitably stay that way. By locating most of King's work in the racist South, we can minimize the racism and despair that existed in the North and still does. It's the work of the last few years of King's life, I believe, that becomes unsettling and inconvenient. Those years go to the heart of who we were and are as a people, of where we set our priorities, both personally and as a nation. The things that King wrestled with in those later years were not dreams. They were and still are nightmares. Those later years changed him in the perception of many from somewhat of a saint, that Nobel Peace Prize winner and a champion for the rights of Black people in the South, into an embarrassment in the view of many people, including some of his earlier supporters. It's easy to focus on the completed dreams. It's true that everybody can vote now, at least in theory, and anybody can live in a house that they can afford, at least in theory. Perhaps it's the continuing nightmares of the things he was dealing with that should haunt us. The continuing of screening job applications by the name of the applicant, and the reality of who is shown what house based on their race, and the still differing rates of mortgage rates for Black and White Americans, and I could go on. I'd refer you to a book called The Color of Wealth by Barbara Rhodes and friends. These nightmares continue. It's just that we as white folks can ignore them since they don't touch most of us directly. King's later work began in Chicago around the issue of school segregation, which existed in the North too and not just the South. His Southern Christian Leadership Council got involved in the struggle for integrated education in early 1965, and King recommended to President Johnson that all federal aid be cut off to segregated schools. But he didn't stop with raising awareness that school segregation was found in the North as well as the South. By the summer of 1965, well in advance of public opinion, King was calling for a negotiated settlement in Vietnam. King believed that violence was wrong on all levels, and he was deeply concerned about the disproportionate numbers of young Black men involved in the war. Many within the civil rights movement opposed him taking such a public stance against the war, fearing that this would dilute their cause and diminish financial support if civil rights organizations were perceived to be anti-war. Some even used King's calls for dialogue with the North Vietnamese to accuse him of being a communist sympathizer or even a communist himself. Throughout 1965, King expressed his growing awareness and concern about conditions in the northern urban ghettos. The problems were not out in the open, he said, as they were in the South. And he believed that most white people still fail to grasp the depths and dimensions of racial injustice. This is still the case for many of our fellow citizens, as indicated by the recent attacks on diversity programs and critical race theory, as well as attempts to purge libraries of all books about racism, especially those for younger readers. It's much easier to pretend that discrimination no longer exists, or that maybe it never did at all, or that at least it was located only in one area, than it is to try to face it and dismantle it. King was deeply troubled by the Watts riots in August of 1965. He seemed stunned by the hopelessness, despair, and rage in the North, which he believed led to those riots. He said to a friend, "I worked to get these people the right to eat hamburgers anywhere. Now I've got to do something to help them get enough money to buy them." He decided that the civil rights movement needed to bring the issue of northern ghettos to national attention, not just schools, but housing, political emasculation, poverty, welfare, and jobs. He spoke against what he called America's vicious class system and called for sweeping economic reforms. King said, "I have constantly watched my dream turn into a nightmare, constantly watched my dream shattered." In 1966, King turned his attention to the issue of open housing in Chicago. After several marches into white and legally segregated neighborhoods, a group of people, including King, hammered out an agreement that he believed would provide access to housing outside of the slums. Many Blacks, as well as whites, believed that he had acted too quickly and naively. And in fact, the agreement had very little real effect. It wasn't until the Fair Housing Act in 1968 that it became illegal to have clauses in deeds forbidding the sale of property to non-whites. The history of how that was done so systemically is appalling. In the South, disagreements between King and other civil rights leaders arose over tactics, philosophy, and especially over the war. Even slogans became problematic. That phrase, "Black power," was gaining popularity, and King felt those words were too aggressive, too confrontational. There were events that deteriorated into shouting matches between Black power from one group and freedom now from another. And King began to be seen by a substantial number of Black activists as being outdated and naive. Many people felt that violence was understandable, in combating racism, and even justifiable given the situation in the northern ghettos. Maybe it was even advisable, possibly the only way. King opposed the rise of violence within the movement. He attributed the rage in northern ghettos to a lack of political and especially economic power, and he turned his attention increasingly toward the problem of poverty. King spoke about all of this in June of 1966 when he gave the keynote speech called the Ware Lecture at our UUA's Annual General Assembly. In 1967, King identified three key problems in America, the ones that he thought were the biggest, and they were militarism, racism, and materialism. He said, "I am convinced that we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must shift from a thing-oriented to a person-oriented society. When machines and profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." King began to speak out increasingly against U.S. aggression in Vietnam and also in Central America, and this was in the mid-60s. He said, "I can never raise my voice against the violence in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greater purveyor of violence today, my own government." By then, King was widely seen by that government as a nightmare. He no longer had Johnson's ear. Indeed, he was under constant surveillance by the FBI. He was no longer confronting Bull Connor, but the entire structure of his country. Most civil rights leaders felt that his public stance against the war hurt the movement, and the efforts within his own organization to address so many issues often made it feel so scattered over many projects and causes as to become quite ineffective. King remained strongly opposed to the use of violence, and he was terribly upset by the riots that broke out in 1966 and 67. He felt they were immoral and ultimately ineffective. However, he did move to advocating for massive planned civil disobedience. He believed organized large-scale disobedience could disrupt the system to the point that a radical change must happen. Earlier, King had felt that if only people saw that the way they were acting was immoral or unchristian, they would certainly change. Now he came to believe that, in his words, people don't respond until their own self-interest is threatened. People don't give up money and power voluntarily. We must so threaten nonviolently that the self-interest of power finds change essential. And in April of 1968, King went to Memphis in support of a garbage collector strike that had formed in protest of the death of two black sanitation workers who had been crushed by a malfunctioning garbage truck. Again, his work was broadening to try to address more places and more forms of injustice. He believed the struggle in Memphis was indicative of a much wider nationwide struggle for economic equality and social justice. "We've got some difficult days ahead," King said on the evening of April 3rd in his famous "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech. And the next day, on April 4th, 1968, King was murdered. He had indeed become a nightmare, addressing what he believed were national nightmares. What he was addressing was no longer a situation isolated in the towns of the Deep South, as many had been able to believe. He was attacking the basic economic and political structures of our entire country. He was attacking our military strategy, attacking poverty as a systemic evil. He was calling for full employment, for a guaranteed income, for equal access to education on all levels, and for health care. He came to believe that American materialism was based on military imperialism and that the entire system was in need of a radical transformation. He was always upset and antagonized. He had always upset and antagonized a large number of Americans. Now even many of his earlier allies were upset with him, even hostile. And many other African Americans, especially the younger generation, saw him as outdated and out of touch. King himself had become less optimistic about the likelihood of change. He questioned whether most white Americans had any real interest in change. In the last years of his life, he was often deeply depressed, saying that he knew he would probably pay with his life for exposing the magnitude and depth of the problems that he was bringing to light. King raised many, many other issues during those last few years. I would refer you to David Garrow's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Bearing the Cross, for an extensive retelling and reexamination of those years. None of those issues were easy to solve at the time. None of them have disappeared. Okay. The poverty gap continues to widen, and militarism is still very much present. Indeed, we've heard rumblings recently that our own military could be used against those who entered our country without required documentation, or even to claim or reclaim land for the United States from beyond our current borders. Materialistic Americans, which is most all of us, including myself, when I look at the contents of my bookshelves and my closet, materialistic Americans claim an ever greater proportion of the world's riches, and we continue to do so. And we contribute way more than our share to the world's woes, especially in terms of climate threat. Laws protecting many minorities in our country are under attack, not only racial and ethnic minorities, but also LGBTQ and trans communities and others. Resources for those who have little, including the unhoused in Bennington, continue to shrink. Healthcare resources are increasingly strained, even for those who do have insurance, and the list goes on. We have not solved those problems. And yet, so often, when we think about King, we want to focus on his dreams and his early optimism. It's comfortable to focus on the parts of his work that seem finished, that work that resulted in the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, and celebrate that even as parts of those acts come under attack. Too often, we want to stay with the optimism of how long, not long, and hope that that's still true. I'm not sure it ever was, and it's difficult to accept how much work still needs to be finished or shored up or even tackled for the first time. If we are to truly honor the life of Martin Luther King, we would do well to focus on the situations that he spotlighted in those last few years. What can we do now to move toward any kind of economic parity? How can we address the despair of racism or poverty or housing discrimination? How can we live in a country where nonviolence is not used in dealing with other countries? How can we live out his kind of fierce justice, the kind that demands change, even in places that we could ignore? More personally, what would each of us need to change in our own lives to make some small movement toward a more just world? The nightmares that King saw in his last few years are still all too present, and I suspect there are likely to be attempts to make them even more prevalent in the coming months. Perhaps we need not so much to celebrate King's accomplishments and the courage that he used in accomplishing what he did, as to use that courage to goad us, be a model for the work that we need to do, an inspiration. May we find such courage, and may we dare to dream ourselves and then dig in for the very, very hard and long work of turning those dreams into reality. May we slowly find ways to end what King saw as nightmares.